You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Thank you. I'd like to welcome everyone here today. My name is Tom Wright. I'm a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy and Director of the Center for the US and Europe here at Brookings. And it's a pleasure to welcome everyone here today to talk about the future of the liberal order. In fact, the zombie Western liberal order, as we call it. That's now its formal term in the White House, I understand. And we're delighted to be joined by three terrific panelists. We have Ralph Fuchs, who is a very old friend of Brookings and the president of the Heinrich Böll Foundation. My colleague, Constanza Stelzenmüller, who's a senior fellow for the Center for the U.S. and Europe. And my colleague, Bob Kagan, who's a senior fellow at the Project on International Order and Strategy. On behalf of the Center for the U.S. and Europe, I would like to extend our gratitude and appreciation, particularly for Ralph Fuchs, as he transitions out of the presidency for the Heinrich Böll Foundation. Brookings has been delighted to have a long-standing partnership and collaboration with the foundation, and this successful collaboration is due in very large part to Ralph's leadership and his hard work to grow the foundation from a handful of people to a forum for policy debate and discussion and an influential voice for advancing democracy, human rights, and green values around the world. So thank you very much, Ralph, and it's
thank
a great
you.
Pleasure
very gracious.
To speak with you today. I would like to note, just before we begin our discussion, to reiterate Brookings' commitment to independence and to underscore that all the views expressed today are those solely of the speakers. Unfortunately, I wish they could represent a much larger movement, but they are actually just our own views. So I wasn't in it, but I understand that we actually had Rob to speak a couple of weeks after the election on the future of the liberal order back in November. And it just struck me as I was preparing for this panel, if 4 years ago one was to say that Donald Trump would be president of the United States, that Vladimir Putin would have invaded and annexed part of Ukraine, that Britain would have left the European Union, that Marine Le Pen would be in the runoff for the French election, and then they said, what do you think that would be like? I think people would say, well, that could be the end of the liberal order. And certainly, I think, on the event that you had just a couple of weeks after the election, there was a feeling that it was existentially threatened. Since then, there's been various sort of antibodies that have emerged, the mainstreamers within the cabinet in the Trump administration pushing for alliances and for some preservation of America's traditional foreign policy, the emergence of Macron in France, who may very well win the presidential election. And the question I'd like to start off with is, you know, where do we sort of stand on this thing that we call the liberal order? Are we looking at its end? And if it doesn't end under these circumstances, is it basically indestructible? Is it basically like a zombie that you can hit it as many times as you want, but it will reemerge continuously because it's actually much more strongly and deeply rooted than we anticipated? Or in 4 years, when we look back and say that the Trump administration was actually the end of this post-Cold War or even post-war moment. So, Ralph, if I could start with you maybe, and how does it look from where you sit?
Thanks a lot, Tom. And again, thank you for the kind introduction. I hope it will not be my last time at Brookings, but for sure it's my last time in my function as the president of the Böll Foundation. Yes, maybe you are right, and we already have seen a kind of turnaround moment regarding the rise of populist politics and populist leaders, and that the series of events, the British referendum on the Brexit and the election of Donald Trump and the Netherlands then elections and the threat of Marine Le Pen becoming president of France had been working as a kind of wake-up call. A wake-up call to civil societies and to the democratic political spectrum than in the West, but I would say it's far too early and premature to lean back and to think it's over. So we will not return just to normality. If we take the last 20 years or 25 years after the fall of the wall as the new normal, the election of Donald Trump as U.S. president will remain a disruptive moment for the future of the international order, of the balance, global balance of powers, and especially for European security and transatlantic relations. And we are confronted with a situation that the very country that acted as main guarantor of the liberal order since 45 is now challenging this order. If we define the global liberal order as a kind of global governance system based on liberal norms, on growing international trade, and on supranational cooperation based on supranational institutions, so a kind of multilateral than global order. And I think we can see the fractions within these global governance system, not only because now the U.S. administration is challenging it, but because internationally we already have seen a kind of tight change from the democratic wave after 89 and 90, when Francis Fukuyama published his famous thesis of the end of history. And the end of history, of course, didn't mean it will all stay as it is. There will be no change, no development. No, the meaning of that thesis was there is no systemic competition anymore. The liberal democratic order, or the combination of capitalism and liberal democracy, this is now the global model. This is the paradigm the whole world is following. And that's over, definitely. We have seen the rise of more and more self-assertive authoritarian regimes. China, Russia, Iran, nowadays also Turkey and then others, who see themselves as an alternative to the liberal order, to democratic universalism. But the dramatic point we have reached now is that we see that challenge from within. And it's not only the US, it's also Europe. We've already been talking about Brexit, and also when Marine Le Pen, which I'm quite optimistic, will not become the French president. We have all over the place in Europe these kind of nationalistic, xenophobic, authoritarian movements and parties with 20 to 30% of the public vote. 20 to 30% of the public vote. Also in relatively prosperous and stable countries like in Scandinavia or in the Netherlands. So I would say there is something fundamentally changing also within our societies. And if we are talking about the future of the liberal order, it's not only a foreign policy issue. It's also an issue of our domestic politics. And we have to, I hope there will be an opportunity to go a little bit deeper into that in the following hour. We have to think about what went wrong. What went wrong with globalization? What went wrong with the financial crisis? What went wrong with growing inequality and social polarization in our societies? And also with the cultural revolutions, the cultural transformation, which obviously is seen by parts of our population as a threat, and how can we find different answers to these challenges, reaffirming the promise of equal opportunities, of social belonging, of social coherence in our societies, and linking that with a new effort to build democratic alliances internationally.
Thank you. Thank you, Ralph. Bob, if I could turn to you next. I mean, do you see this, you know, when we've spoken about this before, I mean, do you think this is sort of has longstanding roots in American foreign policy after the Cold War? Is it sort of mainly a function of Trump? And are we sort of really looking at the end here? Or will in 4 years we bounce back and there'll be some internationalist Republican or Democratic president and they'll sort of repair part of the, you know, damage that has been done and sort of the cycle will continue?
Well, it's a good question. Of course, it's an unanswerable question. We, you know, predicting even 4 months ahead is dangerous and 4 years is even more so. But the reason I feel like you can answer it is that Trump didn't come out, I mean, what Trump represents as an American foreign policy viewpoint didn't come out of nowhere. I think, in fact, not only does he speak for a very large number of Americans today on the foreign policy issue, but this has been a growing trend really since the end of the Cold War. And I think it's worth recalling that even in American foreign policy, the role that Americans sort of accepted after World War II was highly unusual. It was highly unusual for any country. In fact, there's almost no, I can't even think of another country in the history of the world that played the role that the United States was willing to play after World War II, which is essentially to take responsibility for an order. Didn't mean it wasn't based on selfishness to some extent, but it really was rather extraordinary. It's not what nations do normally. They look after their own interests, sort of narrowly conceived. That was not something they had done before. It was something, in fact, they had actively rejected after World War I. And it seems to me that it was inevitable, especially after the disappearance of the Soviet Union and international communism, which I think kept that sentiment and that approach alive longer than it might otherwise have been, that after the fall of the Soviet Union, that Americans would begin to question what the point of it all was, especially as generations passed and people who remembered World War II or even the Cold War passed. And now you have several generations that don't really remember any of that and want to know why it is exactly that the United States provides protection for rich countries that are thousands of miles away. It needs to be explained all over again, but it's not an easy explanation to make. So Trump was not the only candidate in this last election who spoke for this point of view. Bernie Sanders did also from a slightly different direction, but ultimately not that different, I think. And even President Obama, after 2008, felt that the American people wanted to be less deeply engaged in the world and was leading the country to some extent in that direction, not as dramatically, but definitely in that direction. So therefore, we're dealing with a larger issue, which is Americans' willingness to take on global responsibility. And I think at the moment, that's very much in doubt. Now, it's not also as if we haven't seen that before. We did see it, obviously, in the 20s and the 30s. And what got Americans out of that mode was the worst catastrophe possible in international relations. So part of me feels like it could come back if there's a crisis that Americans feel warrants their involvement. So I think that is a possibility. But part of me also thinks the fall of France didn't do that, really, until Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. So I don't know what would require it this time. And then just in general, I totally agree that our tendency to feel like we're out of the woods just because, you know, Macron got point what percentage higher than Le Pen did in the last election, I think is a mistake. I think we're very much in this in a fundamental way, not just in terms of the American role, which I think is in doubt, but also in terms of the crisis within the liberal order itself, mm-hmm. Which we have also seen before. I mean, you know, in the 20s and 30s, and even before the Depression, set in. We had the rise of fascism in Italy and elsewhere, and real doubts about democracy, real doubts about the value of democracy, doubts about the value of the capitalist system. We shouldn't assume that this fundamental belief that we think so many people have shared is eternal. We know for a fact that it's not eternal. And so I think the bigger error we would make would be in assuming that things just get back to normal.
Yeah.
What we think of as normal is not normal. What we think of as normal is, in fact, a historical aberration. And it will require enormous effort on our part, I think, to keep alive what has been growing since 1945.
Thank you. Constanze, how do you look at it, particularly from a European perspective, but also more generally?
Right. Well, I unfortunately have to disappoint everybody by agreeing with both Ralf Fuchs and Bob Kagan on the fundamental...
Dear. First time for everything.
I know. Well, I'll try to set myself off in other ways for the course of the discussion. But on the, on the fundamental issue of normal being over, I completely agree. I think that we have had a couple of tight escapes, and the first round of the French election certainly is just that and no more than that. And, you know, I think we would be fools to think that Marine couldn't win the second round. I don't think she will. And one of the reasons is that the French polls, unlike other polls, have so far seemed to be accurate. Far more accurate than others, but it's still going to be a very tight this week. And I think the fundamentals of this, if you look at what happened in France, the two mainstay parties of the French Fifth Republic mm-hmm. have been ignominiously routed and replaced by two parties that are anti-democratic, the FN and Mélenchon's troop, and Macron's party, which is not anti-democratic, is barely a year old, is tiny, and will force the president, if Macron is elected, to find a completely new coalition after the parliamentary elections at the beginning of June. I think you can still see the enormous disaffection, disconnection between French elites and voters. That's expressed in anger everywhere. There's a tremendous metropolitan, urban, and rural/industrial provincial divide. And all that is something that Macron will have to find a way of bridging. And then we're not yet talking about economic reforms and the European reforms that he wants to engage with, and where he actually also is challenging Germany already and saying, you know, we want things that you are on the other side of. I actually tend to think I agree with him, but, you know, he's got his hands full. And I'm using the French example not to bash the French, not that I don't think one shouldn't do that, but I'm perfectly happy to find similar phenomena in my own country, Germany, or elsewhere in Europe. So my bottom line is, if we don't look very carefully at the fundamental sort of tectonic shift pathologies mm-hmm. of our democracies, both in Europe and in America, then we would be making a huge mistake. That said, that is incredibly difficult to do in political climates that appear to be obsessively focused on crisis management and on brokering very short-term agreements between increasingly polarized political camps. So that kind of adjustment is incredibly difficult to do short of an all-out political crisis. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Let me drill a little bit deeper on this. You know, you all mentioned, I think, that the system is sort of weaker than it was, that people are less satisfied with the status quo, that they're sort of rebelling against it in some way, that people may not like support their governments coming up to the, you know, stepping up to deal with sort of problems as they exist, that alliances are fraying. But, you know, since the topic, you know, is sort of the zombie liberal order, I do come back to the question of how does it actually end? Like, how would we know, what are we most afraid of in terms of strategic vulnerability? Like, we look at this administration, right? It's actually given some reassurance to NATO. It's given some reassurance to Japan, some reassurance to South Korea. It's pulled back to some extent from trade war with China, that was on the agenda in the first few weeks of the administration. And so, you know, are we going to end up in 3.5 years? Let's presume it's one term. Do we end up where, you know, the US is less popular around the world? There's reputational damage. There's sort of stagnation on the trade front, on the economic front. There's lots of unilateralism and pullback from the UN and other institutions. But actually, not much else has happened, right? Not much else really bad.
That's your optimistic scenario.
That's the optimistic scenario.
But that's, you know, damage control. Yeah.
There's a genuinely optimistic scenario that's economic growth. But let's set that aside and just assume, you know, is that what we're looking at, or you know, what could actually happen that would damage it? I mean, one thing I've worried about is an actual test of Article 5, you know, that would really push Trump on that. There's a North Korea, you know, contingency that could really destabilize the situation in Northeast Asia. But if I could just ask each of you maybe to say, you know, your like best and worst case scenario about the next 4 years, not just the Trump administration, but also looking whether it's Brexit or France or even the Middle East. But like, what's the range of outcomes that we should be considering from where we sit today, given the constraints that currently exist? So anyone wants to jump in first, or I'll just...
Okay, maybe you're right, but you know, the problem starts with this kind of unpredictability. When the central power, still as a guarantor of last resort for the international order, United States, is becoming unpredictable, we are already in a mess. And I would not dare to decide which factions or which currents within the administration and the Trump camp finally will get the upper hand. I'm still extremely alarmed about the signals surrounding the slogan America First. And I guess everybody in the room knows the political history and the message with this, linked with this parole. America First. So will America go back to, I would say, a very root kind of nationalism, economic and political nationalism? And this will be really not only corrosive, it will be a disruptive factor for the multilateral order. Even more in a global situation where there is no vacuum in global power politics. When the United States is stepping back from its international engagement, others will step in. China will step in, Russia will step in, other regional forces will step in, and the whole balance of power will shift. And in terms of the multilateral order, I hope very much to call another topic, which may be not in the center of your foreign policy agenda, but for Europeans it's extremely important, if the United States will step back from the Paris the climate agreement. This will be not only damaging the international reputation of the U.S., but this will be a very hard blow to the multilateral global governance system. Also in terms of more traditional security policy, of course, I can understand what Bob King was arguing, that we could not expect this kind of imbalance in security responsibilities and security spending and military capacities between the US and Europe could go on and go on forever. I agree with that. And of course, for the Europeans, this is a kind of wake-up call to become more grown up and to take more responsibility for Europe's security. But first, I think it's even if the Europeans will step up, which not necessarily means more spending, but better sharing and pooling of military capacities and more military integration between European armies, we will need the U.S. as kind of not only the nuclear shield of the U.S., but we will need the U.S. as military ally, given the potential threats and crisis Europe is confronted in its east and in its south. So, and will the U.S. be willing to step up to these transatlantic commitments? I don't know. If not, it will become very critical.
Bob or Constanze or whoever wants to.
I mean, let me just say, make a couple of observations. One is sort of a historical one, which is that it isn't so much what crisis emerges in the next 4 years, although there certainly could be major crises, which you can't foresee. It's what the groundwork laid in the next 4 years leads to, or next 5 years or 6 years, whatever it is, leads to somewhere down the road. So, you know, if you think about the 1930s, the 1930s didn't emerge from nothing. Decisions made in the early 1920s, which seemed relatively minor at the time, ultimately proved critical. In particular, America's withdrawal from any responsibility for Europe turned out to create an imbalance, turned out to create French insecurity, which led to the invasion of the Ruhr, which radicalized Germany more than it otherwise, et cetera, et cetera. It didn't seem like a big deal. Well, it seemed like a big deal to the French and the Germans, but Americans could look at it and think that, you know, so what? Similarly, policies that the United States undertook in Asia vis-a-vis Japan, the Washington Naval Agreement, had effects that didn't manifest themselves in both parts of the world until the 1930s. So what I fear more than the immediate crisis is the longer-term crisis that would come from decisions that are taken or not taken now. And I want to agree that the role of the U.S. is critical. We take so for granted the degree to which the existence of an incredibly powerful country that is also sort of uniquely situated geographically has kept a lid on so many. We know all the bad things that have happened. You can't even imagine the worst things that could happen if the United States wasn't playing the role that it's been playing. And so if you and it isn't enough for the United States to sort of be there and not do anything. Because in order to sustain the liberal order, it's not just a matter of staying in place. You're actually constantly active. It's a little like if you cut out a clearing in a jungle and plant a garden, you don't plant the garden and then say, great, the garden's planted, that's it. The jungle grows back. It keeps coming back. And so if you plant a garden, you know you have to constantly weed it. You have to constantly push the jungle back. And if you just stood still, that would be the end of the garden. And I really feel like that is the danger now. And that brings me, and I'll just end on this, the forces, I think that the best you could hope for in the current administration is that you get neutral out of the United States. So the forces that you talk about, Tom, keep Trump from doing terrible things. But it's not enough not to do terrible things. You actually have to be doing positive things. We're going to have, if we're not already in the middle of, a crisis in the Balkans. I'm sorry. I would love to believe the Europeans could handle the crisis in the Balkans themselves. I'm quite confident that's not the case at the moment, and it would require the United States involvement as it has in the past, not dramatically, but to some extent. If that involvement is lacking, you're going to see things happen in the Balkans which have a dramatic effect on the rest of Europe, in my view. And you could take that situation and multiply it times 30 around the world. So mere inaction, that doesn't even have to be hostility to the liberal world order, mere inaction by the United States will undermine the order gradually, if not suddenly.
And just before bringing in Constanza, a quick follow-up. If it gets worse, will that entice the U.S. back in, or will that sort of reinforce the trend?
There's two historical models of the United States to look at. One is the Cold War model, where what you just described is what happened. The United States would pull back for whatever reason, things would happen, and the United States would get back engaged again. I mean, American foreign policy is a sine wave between high periods of high intervention and then periods of retrenchment. During the Cold War, the sine wave was such that the valley, the troughs were shallow and short. And that's how Americans reacted. When they saw a crisis, they came back to life, sort of. Americans responded quite the opposite way in the 20s and 30s. As they looked out at the world, the worse the world got, the more they felt they should stay away from it. Because, of course, the worse things get, the higher the price required to fix it. So as the 1930s unfolded and you had one crisis after another, the American response to that was, keep us out of it, not we better get in. So the question you have to ask yourself as Americans is, knowing your fellow Americans, which is the more likely response today if the world increasingly gets out of hand? And I don't know the answer to that. It could be that it's the Cold War model, or it could be that it's the 1930s model.
But didn't that kind of free thinking already started with Obama? Reflecting the disaster of Iraq. I think this was Iraq was similar to the financial crisis in 2007, 2008. It was kind of turning point. It was a really catalytic element. And it changed the whole thinking about democratic intervention and interventionism.
I mean, again, it's a question of which phase we're in, because you could have said the same thing about Vietnam. Vietnam was a much worse catastrophe, actually, than Iraq was. It was longer. The loss of American life was 10 or 15 times greater. The divisiveness in the country was actually greater than Iraq. And yet, 5 years later, they elected Ronald Reagan, and we were, it was morning in America, and we were going to be a powerful country running the world again. And I think that was, again, due to the existence of communism. What happened? The Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. My God, the whole country said, oh, my God, who cares if the Soviet invaded Afghanistan? Today, would anybody care if Russia invaded Afghanistan? I mean, or the equivalent? So that's the question. What mood are we in at this moment?
Mm-hmm. Constanza, best worst-case scenarios.
Yes, let me give this a shot. I think the problem with crises is that their net impact is so ambiguous. On the one hand, you could argue that crises have always had a galvanizing effect both on the transatlantic relationship and on Europeans. This is true of the Balkans crisis. This is certainly true of the Russian invasion of Crimea and its continued meddling in Ukraine. On the other hand, you could argue that that same effect is negative in that it prevents us from noticing and doing something about the long-term tectonic shifts that I've been talking about and that are both about our relationship with each other and about the stability, the functionality, the legitimacy of our domestic democratic arrangements. Yeah? And I think that so crises aren't necessarily, I think, in themselves a guarantee for us being able to get out of this in any positive way. I mean, arguably, you could also say that the financial crisis made us look into the abyss together, made us realize just how profoundly we are integrated economically with each other, and that, therefore, economic contagion has political consequences, not just for the relationship with European countries among each other, but also between Europe and America. I think that's the first time we understood that to that degree. What have we done about it? Precious little. I mean, we clawed ourselves back from the brink, but basically, while conducting an extremely acrimonious disagreement about the appropriate economic policy, and the question of appropriate political reactions, I think, has been left unanswered. So I think my best case scenario really is, I suppose, a sort of normalization and hoping America doesn't do a lot of harm, or at least under this administration. But then I think I would agree with both Bob and Ralph that that does enormous damage to the legitimacy both of the West and of the American guarantor role. So we're in trouble even in my most optimistic scenario. And my worst-case scenario, God, I can think of so many, we could spend the entire evening here. So I'm going to spare you that, but I think your imaginations can fill it in. I do think that it's worth saying one thing, though. The reason why I'm so worried about these domestic things is that I think we... we foreign and security policy wonks have begun to understand that our domestic arrangements are really important for the bandwidth that we have and for the resources and assets that are at play or can be brought to play in security policy. Now, there's a very direct connection between your domestic growth, say, and your security budget.
Yeah.
But the reality is it is much more difficult these days because of the polarization and the heating up, the anger and resentment and cruelty in political debate these days, to establish the kind of bipartisan consensus that you would need to change things like, say, gerrymandering in America, which cements this political polarization, or, say, Money of Speech, Citizens, the famous Citizens United case, or in the case of Germany, I would say we... our biggest problem, I think, is identity politics and the existence, as we are slowly realizing, of an entire section of the German population, some of it in East German, but not all of it, that thinks of the Berlin government as a somehow illegitimate regime. And they refer to it as the BRD regime. And I think that ought to give us pause for thought. That means that there are people in a very wealthy, growing democracy, supposedly the dominant one in Europe, that think their entire country is based on an illegitimate premise. Now, again, they're not a majority, but that's a festering sore, and it's something that we have to address. That's just by way of example. A final one would be, for me, centralization in the UK and France, an enormous divide between London and Paris on the one hand and the periphery on the other, which has led to feelings of disenfranchisement and alienation politically that I think also are not being addressed.
Thank you. That brings us on. I think we should spend a few minutes on sort of the root causes of this. You know, when Frank Fukuyama wrote his book, The End of History, he had a final chapter in it that went often unnoticed that basically said, at some point this will end because people grow bored, and they essentially are inherently...
I am not having a boredom problem.
They inherently want to be engaged in a struggle, and if they can't struggle on behalf of a just cause, he wrote, they'll struggle against a just cause. They'll struggle against democracy and against peace. And so you'll see these identity and other issues emerge because, you know, inherent to humanity is essentially struggle, and that he thought even without these broader ideological competitions, you would essentially, you know, end up sort of where we are. And ironically, he actually mentioned Donald Trump in that chapter as an example of somebody who was that way inclined. He didn't predict he would win the presidency, but he was one of the people he mentioned. You know, but that, I think, is a minority view. Most people believe that, and I think even he sort of changed his mind and sort of came to believe that it's more to do with dysfunction of democratic societies, that there's real political flaws in the systems that we have, that millions and tens of millions of people are left behind economically.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is, you know, is this movement or is this populist or nationalist moment a reflection of a deep failure within democratic societies, that it's a 21st century crisis of democracy? Or is it a function of, you know, some sort of demagogues who sort of got lucky and various identity issues and the overhang of a financial crisis that was actually handled pretty well from a historical point of view, but people are still a bit cheesed off because the recovery's not quick enough? I mean, basically, how serious is the democratic crisis, or is it something else?
Maybe I would like to come back to Bob's comparison to the 20s and 30s, and I'm also sometimes thinking about this kind of parallel. And I think the positive thing we can say is that today democratic institutions are much stronger. and that the roots of liberal democracy, especially in the European societies, in the continental European societies, is significantly deeper than it was in the 20s and 30s, when large parts of the elites had been anti-liberal and anti-democratic. Right. And one of, as an old leftist, former old leftist, one of the significant differences is that today the bourgeoisie is more cosmopolitan and internationalist. And in the 20s and 30s, it was extremely nationalist. So these maybe are the good news. But of course, I think there are similarities. And if I got Bob Kagan right, I have a similar notion of a crisis of modernity. If you look back to history, there is almost a kind of law that ever when we have a kind of acceleration of modernity, you have these kind of counter movements of anti-modern and anti-liberal revolts. And what we have seen over the last 20 years was an enormous acceleration of fundamental changes in terms of economic globalization, which of course is ambiguous or ambivalent for the old industrial societies. We have been losing our monopole on high qualified work jobs and products. We are in a real global competition, not only on high-tech and high-end some product. And this is exercising an enormous social pressure on especially the traditional working class than in our societies. We are confronted with an acceleration of global migration, which again, I would say for the liberal elites is a positive thing, but for parts of our society, they perceive it as a threat. We have experienced a dramatic cultural revolution in gender relations and the family model, the decline of the patriarchalic family model, which for parts, again, especially white male, is a crisis of male identity. And we are in the beginning of a digital revolution which will change fundamentally not only our economies, but our daily life. And it creates, again, kind of similar polarization between winners and losers. And this is one of the core problems of our society, that we had been too long, I would say, ignorant towards this growing gap between winners and losers of modernization. And we have to rethink how to restore the promise of liberal democracy, of equal opportunities, and of equal rights and participation in the social and political life of our societies. The winner takes it all model, to say it a little bit more brutal. The winner takes it all model is partly responsibility for that crisis, and we have to get rid of that.
But I think, you know, your answer is the answer to Fukuyama, because it isn't boredom, and it's much more inherent in, you say, I think correctly, that that modernity creates its own opposition, basically. And what I would put it slightly differently, because it's not so much, in my view, it's the Enlightenment project. Yeah. That we've been engaged in. And the basic principles of the Enlightenment project have been a cosmopolitanism, a view that neither race nor color nor religion nor national boundaries really divides anybody, that we're all the same, And this reaches its, you know, height in Europe and to a lesser extent, but still to a dramatic extent in the United States, with precisely the expansion of rights and mm-hmm. and to people who previously lacked them. And it just seems to me that that has created the reaction, because certainly in the United States, I know that there is an economic element to the Trump phenomenon, but I think a much more important element of it was the perception, particularly of whites, particularly of middle class and lower middle class whites, and particularly of white males, that the whole country has moved away from them, that they have been, that others are being privileged at their expense, and they harbor these deep resentments at what has happened. This is not the first time in American history that that's occurred. I think the 1920 election bears a lot of similarity to the election we just had. That was also a rejection, to some extent, of the progressive approach to the world. It was also a time of economic dislocation, because people were moving off the farms and into the cities, into industrialization. There was also rejection of science and the sort of Darwinian versus the Bible, and you had all these kinds of reactions, and that's what we're seeing now. And I just think that this, the Enlightenment Project, is not the total, you know, we think of it as a culmination of progress, but it could be that it has created its own reaction. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, our method, I mean, when Constanza was talking about how we have to come to grips with this politically, I don't know if there's an answer politically that we could possibly carry out. Because our answer, what you just said, is let's go back to respecting the liberal values and the rights of all. But it's precisely those liberal values that people are challenging. So how does a liberal political system answer that challenge? I don't really see the formula for it.
Constanza, do you have the answer?
Oh, God, I knew this was heading my way. I've been thinking hard about this while both of you were talking, and I'm not sure that I have something that's fully thought out. But it's, I mean, obviously, you know, from a German point of view, we've seen the alternative, and my parents actually lived through it. So for me, this is not quite so hard to connect to. I think for most of us Europeans, I think it's. For us, memories of war and economic deprivation, if not in our own spaces, then in our neighbors' spaces. Mm. You know? And perhaps through these stories, the narratives of the refugees who come to us, you know, from our own neighborhoods, not to mention Syria, do have an impact in teaching us how precious these achievements are. That said, I have had, you know, conversations with my own interns, people in their 20s, for whom I think until Brexit and the American election and the events of this year, it was really hard to imagine that this wasn't something that you could actually take for granted. So I think right now we're living through a series of teachable moments that is actually passing that experience on. But the question is, are we actually being taught enough to preserve what we have? That is a question that I cannot answer. But I, in my sort of darkest moments, it seems to me that what we are seeing is the flip from the assumption that growth would be forever, that the cake would forever enlarge, and therefore there would always be something to distribute, to a situation where suddenly some of us are thinking that even in a Western democracy, life is becoming a zero-sum game, in which there mm-hmm. are winners and losers, and the permanently privileged and the permanently excluded. Now, it seems to me that the nature of Western liberal pluralist democracy is to prevent that from happening. Mm-hmm. You know, a decent society, by our understanding, and that is what differentiates us from places that don't have this model, is that there will never be a permanently excluded class. Yeah. But how do you achieve that when we are on the cusp of industrial automation that will permanently disconnect the labor market from the available jobs? In other words, where there is a very large and possibly very able working population that will never again find an entry into the labour market. Mm. How do you do that? Thus, we know that suddenly conservatives in this country and in mine are discussing the minimum wage and are suddenly becoming accepting of it because that is seen as one of the bulwarks against social unrest in the case of widespread automation. But surely that's not enough. Surely that doesn't solve the problem of the dignity that work and employment affords us. In other words, we haven't even begun to factor in all these problems in our definition of what a decent society under the premises of globalization and integration is. And again, in America the temptation is always to think, oh, we can just disentangle ourselves from the world because we have such a huge space and internal markets and natural barriers and strategic resources that we can do strategic autarky. Whereas we in Europe, you only have to look at a map, obviously can't. If we cut ourselves off from the world, we're gone. That's it. End of the European project. But I suspect that that is an overestimation of American capability for strategic autarky, and that even America would find itself very damaged. So I think that the challenge of the age for us is to figure out how we create this kind of resilience for our democratic system under these conditions that we can't change. What I worry about, though, is that the sort of more hardcore ideological component of this American administration seems to think that globalization is just an ideology, is just a negative attitude, and that if you recant from it, like from a bad religion or a sort of bad philosophy, then you can somehow go back to some mythical time and space where where states are sovereign and control themselves and where none of this is a problem. That's the biggest possible fallacy. And if I think there is one recipe for disaster, particularly in this country, then it is that assumption sort of becoming the driving principle for American policy.
Well, in some ways, I think it was the fact that Trump's view was to go back to the 50s, right? That meant that he was unable to execute effectively on his policy, right? I mean, it's remarkable they didn't have, Trump didn't have a set of think tanks trying to think about how to turn his views into policy. They hadn't prepared anything about governance. Even in Europe, some of the nationalistic movements haven't really thought very hard about governance. But now that people realize that this type of nationalism or protectionism is popular, presumably some enterprising politicians will begin to think about how to operationalize it, and they'll be smarter, and more subtle than Trump. That would not be hard; it's a low bar, but they will be, they will be more subtle than him. And I guess just, are we seeing, Ralph? Maybe I could put this to you, just on what Bob and Costanza mentioned. I mean, and what you mentioned. Are we seeing a realignment where it's no longer left versus right, but as many people have said, it's open versus closed? Or you may see a combination of the left and the right on the one hand and a combination of the left and the right on the other. And what does that mean really for our societies and then for the international system in order more generally?
Yeah, interesting question. We are struggling with that for a couple of years, and I would say the traditional left-right divide of the political landscape will not disappear. It's still a paradigm within people are identifying themselves and localizing themselves in the political spectrum, especially if it comes to economic and social policy issues. But I would agree that meanwhile, another line of conflict or a line of divide has become more important and is becoming more and more dominant. And this is just this kind of contradiction between those political and societal forces who I would say are promoting liberal values in its best tradition, including cosmopolitanism, openness, multilateral global system, cultural diversity, equal opportunities for all within let's say, a solid framework of democratic institutions, balance of powers. And another camp, which is nationalistic, anti-globalization, anti-migration in Europe, anti-EU, and is flirting with some kind of strongman rule. You know, this resentment against parliamentarian democracy and the idea of that democracy is the unity between leadership and people. So, and this is, you can find forces from the traditionally more left or more right in both camps. You can see it now in France with this interplay between Mélenchon and Jean-Marie Le Pen. You can see it in the programs of these parties. They are all protectionist. They are all believers in national sovereignty as the highest political principle. Yes, I think the main axis today, internationally both and domestically, is the conflict between liberal and anti-liberal political forces. And especially for people coming from the left, you know, there had been a long-term, I would say, reservation from the left against liberal democracy. It was seen only as a kind of facade of capitalist rule. And for the traditional left, the core or the crucial question was not democracy or authoritarianism, it was capitalism or socialism. And this is one of the, I think, the really tragic historical errors we have to overcome. The difference between authoritarianism and democracy, this is the main conflicting line of modernity.
Thank you. Before we go to questions to the audience, I have one question for both Bob and Constanza. Bob, just for you, on one country we haven't mentioned yet is Britain, which is, you know, really interesting because the UK has, you know, been a key partner of the United States in upholding the liberal international order, but for whatever reason, over the last 2 years, both, you know, left and the right seem to have gone slightly mad, and we had the left sort of implode under Corbyn, and you know, and the right sort of moved toward Brexit and sort of a hard Brexit under Theresa May. She seems certain to be returned as Prime Minister. And so my question is, like, where is this headed? Like, let's assume Brexit happens. It's not, you know, talk about the negotiations, but assume that occurs. What role will Britain, do you think Britain will take in upholding the liberal international order? Will it continue to be outward-looking and global and a partner of the U.S., or are we looking at something very different?
Well, it's a great question, and it leads me to mention one thing, which I think is important, which is that there is a global phenomenon that we're witnessing, but everything is different in each country, because each country has very different circumstances and very different histories. So, for instance, I don't really think there is an alternative to democracy in the United States, because that's the only thing the United States is. It's the only thing it's ever known. It's very hard for me to imagine how that happens. Now, things can get worse. We can violate people's rights. We've done that historically in the past. But the democratic system itself, I just don't see any plausible alternative, whereas most other countries in the world have had alternatives. They've been, you know, France has been France not being a democracy, and like that's true of every country in the world. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, when you ask me, if you talk about Britain, I find, even though we think Brexit from a short-term point of view or a current moment, it seems like it was not the smartest thing for Britain to do, there's nothing more natural than Britain separating itself from the continent. I mean, you could just say that the aberration is not Brexit. The aberration was being part of the EU in the first place, or being that closely associated with Europe in the first place. That's not Britain's traditional posture. So the question is, what do you, you know, how much do you want to read into this other than normalcy? Now, but and therefore you get to the question that you're asking. The problem that Britain has is that it has been, in pure power terms, in hard power terms, Britain has never recovered from World War I and has been basically in secular decline as a military power ever since. It fought above its weight throughout the Cold War and to some extent after the Cold War, but the trend has been toward decreasing power in the international system. And I think that trend will continue. I don't see anything in the British mindset now. There are people who are optimistic that once Britain, you know, exits, it then goes back to being the old Britain, the old partner of the United States. I'm not sure that that's true, and I don't see much. I don't see many people in Britain who even aspire to that. I think that what you're likely to see is a small England. Possibly just in England, by the way, because I still don't think you can rule out Scottish independence. So I think it would be foolish to bank on Britain as a major partner in upholding the liberal world order in the years to come.
Thank you. Constanze, final question to you before we go to the audience. You know, Chancellor Merkel has been described as leader of the free world. There's lots of people looking at her, including today, more praise for her today, meeting with Vladimir Putin, speaking up for human rights in Chechnya and elsewhere in Russia. You know, looking beyond Chancellor Merkel, I mean, is this a mantle that the German people are willing to take? Obviously Germany can't replace the United States, but in terms of all the things the U.S. does around the world, but is this something that the German people want to do if there was a vacuum, that they would want to do more to play a bigger role?
It's a mantle I wrap myself in every morning before I leave the
house. Well,
but to be serious, look, I'd like to respond to what Bob's just said.
And dodge my question, okay.
And I'm not going to dodge your question, I'm coming to it, don't worry. But I do think there's ways in which the US can abandon democracy without forsaking it. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that fundamental principles of the American constitutional order have been challenged in the last 6 months overtly in word and deed in ways that I would have thought unimaginable. The independence of the judiciary, the freedom of and the special privileges accorded to the press by the First Amendment, the separation and balance of powers, and I could go on. That, to me, was unimaginable, and I think it ought to be challenged and it ought to be identified as such. It is a questioning of the fundamental questioning of the American order. On the UK, I tend to agree with you. I think that the Brexit is premised on the notion of checking out of the kind of deep integration that the EU has pursued, often haphazardly, often in ways that are burdensome or bureaucratic, but mostly are supposed to be in response to supposed to be an acknowledgement of the fact that we have been growing together. And as I was saying earlier, the financial crisis proves that that's true even of the transatlantic space, and it's certainly true of Britain's role in Europe, regardless of whether they're sitting on an island or not. The geographical, sort of the geospatial positioning has nothing to do, sadly, with the fact of economic and social and political integration. So I think that the Brexiteers are going to have a very, very unpleasant awakening. They will find themselves having promised a return to state control over outcomes and policy that they cannot possibly fulfill, and they will then find themselves in a very tricky place. Now, to answer your question about Germany, look, Merkel was the first to repudiate this notion of Germany as the savior of Europe. But, I mean, the truth...
Savior of the world.
Savior of the world, yes, I'm sorry, that too. The reality, I mean, it is true that Germany has found itself in a role that is somewhat similar to that of America and the West, in that we are being asked to take on responsibilities for, at least for regional and European order, in ways that previously only the Americans have done. And in that, you will find the German government and German policy elites and academics and intellectuals actually trying to provide a response to this in policy and in practice. That's really new for my country, and I think it's worth acknowledging that at least it's trying. That said, we couldn't be more conscious that we're not in the position of America, and that we will that there is no way of Germany perhaps taking on a burden commensurate with its economic power and its size as an economy that doesn't include our making some very significant trade-offs and concessions towards our neighbours. And I would say that on that particular count, we have been at best semi-successful. And in fact, there have been German government policies for which we are going to pay, we're either already paying or will pay in the future because they've made us critics or even enemies within Europe and beyond. I'll stop here because I'm sure there are a lot of questions.
Let's go to the audience. So we have a microphone. And so let's take them in threes, actually. So the lady here in the front row, gentleman behind, then gentleman here. Yeah. And if you could just say your name and...
I'm Mitzi Wirth. I'm with the Naval Postgraduate School. This has been really fabulous. I mean, really fabulous. I was stunned this summer that none of the think tanks, except Hudson, were thinking about the folks who were feeling left behind and what that was doing to us. Now, I think the whole question of technology has turned the world upside down. And it's not clear how we're going to get out of that. But my question is, when the intellectuals get so caught up with their way of thinking and they're not accepting these concepts of complexity, because everything seems to me is so interdependent, but we don't get enough of that explained to the public, how do we get to that point of explaining to the public? I mean, things are written in code. Nobody can understand how the government works. I mean, when they say that 3/4 of the U.S. voters didn't know we had 3 branches of government, you know we're in trouble somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I it seems to me that think tanks...
Including the president.
What?
Including the president.
Oh,
well. We're really in
trouble. It's your citizenship
gentleman,
test
gentleman
next
behind.
Week.
Gentleman behind. Thank you.
My name is Stephen Shore. 2 brief points. Could anyone explain the enduring power of the Dolchstoßlegende, that it has crossed the Atlantic and it has, in the speeches, not just of our president, but of Sanders as well, of the innocent American people victimized by those nasty others. Well, the others might differ, but it's essentially the same appeal to resentment and hatred. And even if we could restore we seem to be in a paradox that for some, that if only we could restore the liberal democratic order, that would make America great again.
Great, thank you. And we actually have 2 right here, so we'll just take them together and we'll go back to the panel. Yeah.
Yes, I'm Norman Birnbaum. Thanks to the panel for an unusually stimulating and unusually depressing discussion.
We try.
This is 2017, and 500 years ago there occurred an event which apparently is a very well-known, very well-kept historical secret called the Protestant Reformation. And historians of the Reformation, whether they're Catholic or Calvinist or Lutheran or Anabaptist or secular, now for centuries have insisted that, well, the church was never so strong. The pre-Reformation was there for anybody except the papacy to read it and so on. So the question, let's shift this to the historiography of the liberal order. Was the liberal order so liberal? Was it so well-rooted? Was it so orderly? Or are we now, so to speak, experiencing things we didn't previously see or wish to see? Finally, for Bob Kagan and American democracy, I think that because of age, I can claim to be one of the few people in this room who in 1941 participated in street demonstrations against America First outside Madison Square Garden. There were street battles, and the America First movement was not merely a movement of withdrawal, but had real authoritarian and fascist tendencies, whether there's some connection to the Trump family or not is quite an interesting question.
Final question, to Strand, the gentleman here.
Lou Gagliano. It seems to me that both the United States and the European group have two issues. One is domestic, and how do you make yourself more effective to those who have been left behind? And the other is world order, or at least regional order. And I think the U.S. defines it as world order. And what I mean by world order is, how do you control some of the rogue nations with proliferation of nuclear armament when the United Nations can't do anything except have meetings? So what is the role of both of these entities?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. So let's go back to the panel and just a lot on the table there, everything from the Reformation on forward. So about 45 seconds. No, I'm just kidding. Ralph, why don't we start with you?
Maybe just two remarks. The first one concerning the Dolchstoßlegende. It's typical, you know, for all these...
Stab in the back thesis of...
Stab in the back.
Anti-Weimar Republic.
To the German political answer to the defeat.
You didn't leave it to the American to do the translation with the two Germans at the thing. Sorry.
didn't get it. This is part of the worldview of all these kind of right and left-wing populist movements. You know, reducing the complexity of the modern world to these kind of conspiracy theory. There is somewhere a headquarter of evil. Also, I would say my own political community is not completely free from that. Wall Street, the financial capital. But you have this kind of thinking exploded with the new social media. It is directly related with the structural change of our then public debate. And social media then have become a kind of multiplier and a catalytic force for these completely disconnected worldviews, reinforcing themselves. And this is part of the challenge. How to reach out to people who are, meanwhile, moving in these kind of parallel worlds. I can go deeper in that, but this is also a challenge to think tanks and political foundations. And this is the second remark: political education matters. Political education matters to enable people to read complexity and to deal with this enormous storm of controversial information and to build up their own enlightened than political judgment. This is a kind of precondition of democratic political culture, and this is a huge challenge to both our educational system and to our media.
Thank you. Constanze?
Well, I have been fascinated by the whole stab-in-the-back Dolchstoßlegende thing because it has always seemed to me that that was a characteristic of fundamentally authoritarian cultures. In other words, it's something that I have encountered in Russia, mm-hmm. in German history, of course, in China. Mm-hmm. If you go to the Chinese Foreign Ministry, officials will spend a long time explaining to you the rape of the Summer Palace and so on. And how opium was brought to China, et cetera, et cetera. And I've always thought that if you saw that pop up in your own backyard, you were going to be in trouble, which is why I am so concerned at it popping up not just in the American electoral narratives, but also in Europe. And this we certainly know from German history and from the Nazis. The Nazis always portrayed themselves as victims mm-hmm. while they were preparing to kill people. You know? I mean, the best case in point is the famous Himmler speech, you know, to an assembly of the SS where he said, you know, it's really horrible that we have to do all these nasty things, but we're the ones who are taking on the responsibility for the ethnic cleansing of Germany. I mean, that is the definitive version of that narrative. And it's as revolting in that version as it is in any other version. It is self-serving, it is hypocritical, and it is frankly evil. And it needs to be resisted. But it's also a sign, I mean, it is a sign, I think, for something toxic festering underneath what we have been thinking of as the healthy and functional state of our democracies. And I think we need to pay attention to it. And I think the biggest challenge for us is then distinguishing between what are real and legitimate and imaginary or illegitimate grievances.
You're not suggesting we see that extent in the democracies today.
No, but what I'm saying is that it's part of the narrative of the extreme left and the alt-right in this country, and it's been normalized by some of the people who are a little closer to power. I'm going to put this very carefully. Yeah? And I think that that ought to give us, and the fact that that clearly has resonated, it's struck a chord with a large swath of the American electorate, and it's striking a chord with the French electorate, the British, and even the German, if you look at German state and local elections, then that has to give us pause for thought. There are clearly people who are vulnerable to this narrative, and who, while they know that the people peddling it are pursuing strictly self-interested and parochial purposes, they know that it may empower them as well. And so, again, I mean, I think at the very least what we need to do is look at what of their grievances are real and legitimate and try to address them. And as Bob rightly says, they're going to be different in different spaces. Norman, I would not have been surprised if you said that you had been protesting the Protestant Reformation as well. But... I would believe that, but but I think I take your point. I do take your point that the much vaunted liberal Western order was occasionally illiberal and often not orderly, and that there was exclusion there as well. I mean, we have reason to examine our own track record. I'll leave it at that, but I think, you know, we know we can talk on this at length.
Wait, Bob?
You know, I want to try to make a case for optimism, since there hasn't been a lot of that here. But let me explain what I think about, just thinking about the United States. Because, of course, you're right. And it's very important, and we too easily have glossed over our history as just one, you know, marvelous experience of democracy. And, of course, it has been anything but in some respects. And the kind of seething anger and hatred and racism has always also been part of the American experience. And lest we forget, for the first 80 years of our history, we were a sort of a democracy in part, and in part a totalitarian dictatorship, because that's what the South was, based on racism. But it was dictatorial even toward its own people, because it didn't permit certain kinds of discussions to be had. That was America until 1965. And you could go through every period of American history and find, you know, the ugliness and also violations of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. During World War I, we talk about the freedom of the press. The press was not free during World War I. Treatment of minorities, you can only look at German Americans in World War I and Japanese Americans in World War II and the McCarthy period, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the only thing I would say in making that point is that the question is not whether America has always lived up to its ideals, because it certainly has not. The question is, has it been better than many alternatives in the real world? And I think I would say, I feel safe in saying yes. But there are two things about this that I think are important now. In my view, the Constitution does not save us, because the Constitution has been and can be run over. And what saves us is something entirely different and almost religious, which are the principles of the Declaration, which have an unbelievably powerful life in this country.
That's true.
That continually overcomes all these other horrible tendencies. You know, Abraham Lincoln, who was the greatest philosopher of America, he said that you have to think about the Constitution as a a frame of silver. I think this comes from somewhere in the Bible, and maybe you Protestant Reformation people know that. And the frame was around an apple of gold, and the apple of gold was the principles of the Declaration. And he says, the apple wasn't made for the frame was made for the apple. And his basic point was, it wasn't ultimately the Constitution, it was ultimately those principles. And so if you look at the long sweep of American history, and especially recognizing all the horrible ways in which we have violated our principles and violated the Constitution, yet the overall story of America is the constant expansion of rights.
Mm-hmm.
Not the continual expansion of rights, because there are setbacks and then there's deprivation of rights, but the overall trend is a constantly expanding rights, which means that it's the principles of the Declaration that have continued to drive America forward. And that's why, even though I can see terrible things being done in the short term, in the long term, the history of America suggests that that is the most important element. Mm. And that makes the United States different from every other country in the world, honestly. The only country that comes close in that regard is Britain, it seems to me, which in a way knows no other form of thinking other than one that involves liberty. But that is unique, and I think that's what saves us ultimately. By the way, let me just end by saying, it doesn't just happen. People have to fight. You know, you can't just sit back and say, well, thank God we have the Declaration of Independence. But that is my reason for optimism.
Thank you. So we don't finish in a note of optimism, which I think is very important. We're going to take a final lightning round of questions. We're going to go toward the back this time. So there's someone right in the very back and then a couple up here. But very, very briefly, because otherwise we won't have time to get to your questions. So just very quick. Yes.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm a student at Howard University. My name is Jordan Sellers. And since we're talking about the center or the relationship between the United States and Europe, I wanted to talk about same-sex marriage and marriage equality here in the United States and how in the 21st century we've done something very social that has kind of cracked down on some type of hate crime towards that fight for the LGBT community or those who are either homosexual or heterosexual. So what can we continue to do with that type of policymaking so that the rest of the world is embracing our social order?
Great. Thank you. And then, gentlemen, a couple of rows up. Yeah.
Yeah, my question's short. I'm not sure about the answer. Mark Tokola, could you address the relationship between the rise of illiberal democracies or the illiberal non-democracies, Russia, China, Turkey, Hungary, and the populist movements among the democracies? Is that cause or effect or vacuum filling or something else?
Yeah.
Great. And then the lady here in the aisle, and then we'll go back to the panel.
Hi, my name is Sanna Björling. I'm a Swedish reporter working for the major Swedish newspaper. I wonder, it would be interesting to hear you saying something on how now we have in social media, the most news are now shared in social media, and we have increasing these well-known echo chambers, which provides us with something that is totally new, and how that can affect liberal democracies.
Thank you. So I thank you for the questions. And I think we'll go back just for final comments. You can address the questions. You can address anything that came up in the panel. But I think it would be great just to sort of, to look ahead a little bit about Bob already did in his last comment. But what the immediate prognosis is and what, you know, if you've changed your mind in the course of this conversation about where we're headed. So maybe, Constanza, we could start with you and go to Bob and then finish with Ralph.
True. Look, I think marriage equality is a good thing and ought to be preserved. Mm.
Yeah? Could you speak up a little bit?
I'm sorry, I think marriage equality is a good thing and ought to be preserved. Mm. Yeah? I think that is, you know, a civilizational advance as far as I'm concerned. I'm glad that my gay and lesbian friends don't any longer think they have to live in a closet. Yeah, and it was a sad time when they did.
The relationship between authoritarianism and illiberal democracies, well, there are direct relationships in that the authoritarian regimes, at least the Russians, seem to be trying very hard to advance these developments and working towards that. Sadly, I think it's possible for these countries to do that on their own. In other words, the Russian element there is just an add-on. And I think, in other words, that if we focus only on external meddling, we lose sight of the fact that our own democratic vulnerabilities, our own lack of resilience, are the real problem. And the final point I want to make is to speak to what Bob just said about the American democratic history being an expansion of rights. I think that today I'd like to make, and one can make, a similar argument for a European narrative, which is to say that the European project has not just about being imposing bureaucracy and removing sovereignty, but it has been about expanding peace, prosperity, and democratic transformation on the European continent, a continent that has strong memories of wars and deprivation, and that is something of a utopian project on the same lines as the American project, which is why I am particularly troubled by the hostility to the EU that you can hear from some corners of this new American administration. Yeah? That is truly troubling because it appears to diminish the European project to something that is inimical to the American, to America's interests and to American values, whereas the opposite is true.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, I totally agree with that, and I mean, there's things to be critical about the EU, which I'm sure any European would know better than Americans do. But the alternative is the renationalization of Europe, and the renationalization of Europe is a catastrophe from every perspective. It seems to me. It brings back old issues like the German problem. It brings back, and I think it undermines this support of rights. By the way, a German problem which would not be Germany's fault, but just a fact of its power. I'll just say I've already kind of made my big pitch on the U.S., but I do want to say something about the social media thing, because it's really one of the great ironies. It's sort of instructive, because there was no, at one time, if you read Tom Friedman back in the day, there was not, the internet was supposed to be the ultimate enlightenment tool. It was supposed to break down authoritarianism, open up societies, and by allowing people to communicate with each other more easily, it would certainly bring them closer together, which was the original Enlightenment premise about commerce. The Enlightenment premise is the more people get to know each other, the less they're likely to fight each other. And of course, unfortunately, what the internet revealed is that the reality of human beings is that in many cases, the more they get to know each other, the more they hate each other. and that's just a fallacy of the Enlightenment conviction. Mm-hmm. But it's also proved to be a uniquely effective tool for those who wish to undermine democracy. Okay. And it can undermine democracy without anyone externally trying to do it. But there's no question that the Russians, and I think others will ultimately develop this capability, but the Russians are actively using social media to undermine democracy in the West. It's a more powerful tool than they've ever had, more than any number of spies they ever paid for, more than the tens of thousands of nuclear warheads that they had. This may be the greatest threat that they have ever posed. And we are at the beginning, and I hope not at the end, of attempting to address this problem, because it's going to be very hard to address.
Thank you. Bob, Ralph, last word to you.
Yeah. On these two then areas, first, although Constanze already commented on that, the relationship between illiberal regimes and the anti-liberal revolt within then Western democracies, I think we have to be, I agree with Constanze that, of course, intervention of Russia and other authoritarian states is not the root cause for our domestic crisis. But we have to be clear, especially you learned it during your last presidential elections, and For Europe, it's even more obvious that Russia has become the kind of headquarter of a new anti-liberal international, with a very constant intervention in public opinion and then policy making within the Europe and so with a lot of channels. They are using financial channels, propaganda channels, corruption. Russia has become a force in European domestic politics. And we have to be clear about these kind of interferences or interplay between right and left-wing populist movements and Russia. And we have it, meanwhile, already within the European Union with Hungary and more also with Poland. So there is no longer a clear-cut difference between domestic and international. The promise of China and Russia and the others of that kind is, okay, less individual freedom, but more stability, more prosperity, and more belonging, national pride. So, and we have to address these promises. We cannot give the same answers, but we have to recreate a sense of confidence in the future of the liberal democracies. Because the main emotional currency the anti-liberals are playing with is fear. Fear of the future. And as long as we are not successful in restoring that sense that we are able to form and to influence our future, yeah, I think we will keep in the defensive role. We have to recreate a kind of a new narrative of progress, I would say. We have lost the sense of progress.
Quite right.
And the last point, I agree very much with Zhang Bob's. I like that kind of narrative of the magic of the Declaration of Independence, I would say, together with the French Declaration of Civil and Human Rights.
I knew as a European you'd have to bring that up.
Yeah. It's not just about American exceptionalism. It is about the project of the West, and the project of the West is liberal modernity. And this is what we have to adhere to.
I wasn't talking about the United States as if nobody else mattered. I was just talking about the United States. Anyway, I have one more important thing I have to do.
Okay.
Do you? Yes, I do. Because Tom Wright, who is our moderator and therefore too modest to bring this up, has a new book out.
Oh, thanks.
Called All Measures Short of War, which is a brilliant discussion of the current geopolitical competition and what the United States and others need to do about it. And I just want to make sure you all know about this book. Now I'm done.
Thank you.
Very good. Excellent.
Very kind of you. Thank you. And thank you, Bob. Thank you, Constanza. It's not yet, unfortunately. It will be in a couple of weeks.
But so. the miniseries is in production already.
And thank you very much to Ralph. And thank you all for coming. And with that, we're adjourned.
I did.